Hello, everybody. Sorry, I was a bit late today. I just thought I'd start. I want to share a story. I'm just reading about it. It isn't really relevant to this course, but I thought it was a good story anyway. Probably most of you know, or many of you know, the famous comedian Bob Hope. And he lived to be 100 years old. So the story is that when he was on his deathbed, his wife asked him where he'd like to be buried, and he answered, "Surprise me." I don't know what that has to do with Basquiat, but I thought I'd throw that in. Now, in the chapter that we have to talk about today, as usual in Murray Rothbard's book, there are a whole lot of people he talks about. There are many, many different names, but I think there, if we take kind of two themes that come out in the chapter, is very helpful in reading the chapter. If we keep these two themes in mind, it'll help you in organizing what's going on in the chapter. And I think these two themes stand out. Now, one of these is one we've already seen before, and it's one of the dominant themes in the book. Remember, there's a conventional picture of the history of economics that we've talked about a number of times, where economics in the 18th, 19th century is really essentially British. It begins with Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations, 1776, and the next great work is David Ricardo's Principles, 1817, and then goes on John Stuart Mill, Principles of Political Economy, 1848, and then in a period after what we're studying in this course, it would go through Alfred Marshall. And Murray Rothbard is completely opposed to this picture. He thinks that the English or British school of economics has really had the wrong idea, so he doesn't, he's really against it. And he wants to contrast British economics with economics in other countries. In the first volume of his book, where some of you were in my course for the first volume, what Rothbard was doing was contrasting the conventional picture where economics begins with Adam Smith. He was saying, no, the Spanish scholastics and also other economists in France, like Turgot, really developed economics much more and in a much better fashion than the British did. And here, he's continuing that emphasis in this book, in particular in this chapter, but he's doing for 19th century, he said, the really significant developments in economic theory were primarily in France, not in England. So he's going against the conventional picture. And what is it that he likes about French economics? Well, he says French economics was subjectivist, and we should know by now what that means, that when economics is trying to explain how goods get a value or how they get a price, the subjectivist view is that they get their price from the valuations that people place on the goods or services. So the reasons, say, apples cost a certain amount of money will depend on how people value apples. And this is to be contrasted with objective theories of value that say it's the cost of production of the good or service that accounts for its value. So Rothbard is a subjectivist, and he says the French were subjectivists. And One thing he mentioned to you, and I think it's very interesting, although this would have been covered in more detail, in much more detail in his planned third volume, is when people talk about the marginalist revolution of the 1870s, where people really developed the new theory of value, where we had the Karl Menger in Austria, Leon Walras in Switzerland, and W. Stanley Jevons in England. Rothbard says he doesn't really like the term marginalist because that's just what they were really concentrating with on the marginal or last unit of a good. And while they did, of course, marginal analysis was very important, he thinks the important thing is that they were subject to this. So, as I say, Rothbard says the subjectivists, the French, were consistently subjectivists. He also says he likes the French economists in the 19th century because they consistently favored laissez-faire. They thought that the free market was the most desirable economic system, and they were uncompromising about it. So in contrasting the French, who said, well, the French were good, they were subjectivists, consistently laissez-faire. But the English economics was compromising and muddled. Now, in what way was it? Well, according to Rothbard, again, this is something that he intended to develop in his third volume, English economics remained under the influence of John Stuart Mill. You remember when in the lecture on Mill, Mill didn't accept view of value, that value depends on subjective utility. Mill favored cost of production analysis. So Rothbard thinks that even after the subjectivist revolution of the 1870s, when economists came to recognize that value of goods is subjective, English economics retained some cost of production elements that they got from Mill. So unlike the French, the British economists, such as Alfred Marshall, who was the great figure of the late 19th, early 20th century, the author of Principles of Economics, which was the standard text used in England, and that book had a great influence on the Chicago School of Economics. So that Marshall said that both cost and subjective value determine prices. So he incorporated cost of production and subjective value. It wasn't fully subjective. Now, another way that English economics was compromising, muddled according to Rothbard, is in contrast with the French, who consistently favored laissez-faire, John Stuart Mill was wishy-washy, very hard to get a consistent line from him. He very often supported free market measures. He would sometimes oppose various government interventions. He would show what's wrong with them. But he did so in a compromising way. He particularly allowed that for labor unions, that activity to increase wages. He thought wages weren't really determined fully by supply and demand, just like other goods, the price was determined just by supply and demand. He thought for wages, there's room for quite a bit of bargaining, so it was good that unions should play the beneficial role there. And he was also sympathetic to a form of socialism, would be where workers' cooperatives would really run everything. He was sympathetic to that as an ideal. He didn't think that could be put into practice right away. He was sympathetic to that as an ideal. So Rothbard thinks the influence of Mill really was very bad. Remember, when he's writing, he's definitely somebody who has a strong sense of what's good and bad, and he thinks this was a very bad thing. Now, in this contrast of British and French economics in the 19th century, Rothbard is implicitly challenging a famous essay by Friedrich Hayek called Individualism, True and False. And this essay, you can get it, I think it's on the media site, you can get it it was reprinted in Hayek's book, Individualism and Economic Order, I think. So what Hayek did was, he wasn't just talking about economics, it's Rothbard issue, but Hayek contrasted French liberalism, and same contrast as Rothbard is to French and British classical liberalism. Rothbard is contrasting French and British economics, but it really comes to very much the same thing because the economists were classical liberals in both France and Britain. So he says, Hayek says the French liberalism was dogmatic. It had these absolute propositions, government intervention is always bad. And it was Cartesian. What does it mean, Cartesian? Means like Descartes, where you start with some kind of self-evident truth, like Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, I can't doubt that I exist. And you try to deduce everything from that. So Hayek says, well, so it's a political figure trying to deduce a rational politics and prove that the free market system was always best. And he said English liberalism didn't do that. It was based on compromise. It was saying there aren't really, you can't really say that the market is always best. It usually is, but we have to really consider things on a case-by-case basis. So if we examine particular measures of proposed for government intervention, they'll almost always be arguments against them will be stronger than one in favor. We can't really be sure. And also, English classical liberalism, according to Hayek, really respected tradition. Say, there were customary ways of doing things, and even if we couldn't figure out why those ways were the best ones, we should still respect them just on the ground if they lasted a long time. There must be something to them, even if you can't quite figure out what it is. So Hayek says the English way of doing things based on compromise and respecting tradition is better than the French school, which was dogmatic and Cartesian. And Rothbard accepts Hayek's characterization of these two schools, but he has the reverse valuation. Says, well, no, it's good to what Hayek is calling dogmatic, it's really a principled approach, non-compromising approach, and this is to be preferred to the English tradition of compromise, called muddling through, that no, you have to operate according to fixed principles. And so I say, that's the first theme, this contrast of British and French economics that I think, if you bear this in mind, will help you understand what's going on in the chapter. Now, the other theme is this. If you look, if you know your European American history, the end of the 19th century, beginning and middle of the 20th century, were marked by increasing statism. We had the government was coming to take over a lot of the more of the economy than before, and of course we had World War I, massive increase in power of the state, and of course we had the Soviet communism and fascism, Nazism, the New Deal in America. So it was a tremendous period of the growth of the state. But what Rothbard stresses is the period just before this, say the period of 1870, we can have as kind of a cutoff line, because in 1870 was really the time when the European countries expanded and developed colonial empires that greatly expanded their colonial possession. But if you look at the period 1850 to 1870, this was different, that there was an international movement in favor of classical liberalism and free trade. So just because when we're looking at European history, we tend to think of the late 19th, early, most of 20th century periods characterized as a growth of state, Rothbard says this wasn't true in this period of 1850-1870. There was an international movement in favor of classical liberalism. Now, the most famous of the French economists that Rothbard discusses was Frédéric Bastiat. I imagine most of you have read Bastiat. He, as I said, was the most famous economist, but he didn't stand by himself. There were a whole lot of other people in France who had quite similar views. And Rothbard discusses a great many other people who were allied with Bastiat, such as Charles Comte and Charles Dunoyer. I think we mentioned them in previous lectures. These were founders of the French classical liberal school. And these writers were all in the tradition of Jean-Baptiste Say rather than Adam Smith. Remember, the first lecture in this course was on Say, and although, remember, in Rothbard's interpretation, although Say considered himself in the line of, Say himself said sometimes he was a follower of Adam Smith, Rothbard said no, he really wasn't. He had very different views from Smith. So all these French figures are really disciples of Say, including Bastiat. And you note here, I mentioned before, Rothbard throughout the book will never confine himself just to discussing a few central people. He won't say, as he would in standard economic history, say, well, here are the great economists, say you have Smith, David Ricardo Mill. So Rothbard doesn't say, well, just here's my contrasting list of great economists, Cantillon, Turgot, Bastiat. He doesn't just say that, he doesn't just treat these figures by themselves, he puts them in the whole context of other people who were allied with him. And this is something he's gotten both, as I mentioned, the historian of political thought, Quentin Skinner, had this way of doing things where you consider all the writers in their particular schools of thought. And this was also true, Rothbard took this from the person he got his PhD under, the American economic historian, Joseph Dorfman, who had this same approach where you really try to cover all the writers in the period you're discussing. Now, one of Bastiat's most famous essays discusses the broken window fallacy. I suppose many of you read this essay, What is Seen and What is Not Seen. And Rothbard has what I think is an extremely interesting hello, can you still hear me, everybody? Something happened here. I'm not, something's going on here. Hello, is everybody still there? Wait, I'm not seeing my chat here. Hello? Wait a sec here. Okay, good. Yeah, they just transferred something. Okay, good. Could you hold on? I just need to check. I was expecting very important. I'll just be 1 minute. Could everybody hold on 1 minute, please? I'll be right then. Hello? Yes, sorry, I'm back now. Okay, good. So we were discussing, I would say, Basquiat had a famous essay, What is Seen and What is Not Seen, where he gives the broken window fallacy. And Rothbard has a very interesting account of Basquiat's argument, where he treats his essay as kind of a refutation of in advance of Keynesian economics. Now, in the story, remember the story, a boy hurls a brick through a store window. Sounds like a good idea to me, and I don't think it's going to cause prosperity, but a lot of fun hurling a brick through a store window, you know. Don't knock it if you haven't tried it. So, now the common sense reaction is the boy's activity is destructive. He's tossed a brick through the window. And he's doing that. There's been a net loss of wealth in society. Before we had a window that was all right, but now there's a window that's broken. But there's a second level of thought that now comes in, and this is the one Basquiat presented. Someone says that the boy's activity wasn't destructive. Why not? Well, because the window's broken, the store owner has to buy a new window. So he's going to go to the glazier, the one who sells glass pane, and when he'll have to spend money on that, so that's going to help the glazier. He's getting customers. If there weren't the broken windows, the glazier would lose a lot of business. So now the glazier is going to take the money he gets and spend it on other things, and this is going to spread prosperity and employment through the economy. Well, if something breaks, then you have to get it repaired, so you're going to start spending a lot of money. Now, what's wrong with this? It isn't really that hard to figure out. It's true that the store owner spends money to repair the broken window, and this generates income and employment, just as the person suggested who sent breaking the windows, really helping the economy. But we have to ask, and this is where the part what is not seen comes in. What's seen is that the store owner with a broken window is spending money, and that money will be spent on other things. But not seen is that if the window hadn't been broken, then the store owner would have spent the money on something else. They had a certain amount of money they now have to spend on getting a new window. Maybe they would have spent it on something else, like getting bars for his window so juvenile delinquents wouldn't be able to throw a stone through the window. So had he done that, had he spent it on something else, then that spending would have generated income and employment through the economy. He might have put it in the bank, and then the bank would have lent the money out to people who had investments in mind. So if you consider what the store owner would have done had the window not been broken, then you can see that the spending on the broke for the broken window produces no net gain. The person who says it does is just looking at what seemed, says, well, there's this spending because by the broken window, but he's not considering that had the money not been spent on the broken window, it would have been devoted to other uses. And then you say, well, okay, you have alternative stories. One, you have spending on the broken window. One, you have spending on things that would have taken place if the window hadn't been broken. So say you can't say that for sure that spending on the broken window will be better than spending on the things that would have occurred had the window not been broken. Then you could say, well, how do you know that it's worse? I mean, what makes it worse from the kind of point of view of society, if we could speak that way loosely? Why can you say that it's worse if the window is broken? Well, it's because you have a destruction of resources in the, you couldn't say a priori there's more employment or prosperity generated from the stream of spending without the broken window than with it, but in one case you have a broken window and the other case you don't, so there's been kind of a net loss there. Now, you might think that this broken window sounds so obvious that no one really committed. I see some people in the chat have pointed out that people do commit it. But in fact, this fallacy is the basis of at least one version of Keynesian economics, or Keynesian economics based on the famous book of John Maynard Keynes, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, came out in 1936. Now, Paul Krugman, a famous Nobel Prize winning economist, I think 2008 Nobel Prize winner, says today, well, we're not doing so well in the American economy today, so in order to get the economy going, the government has to spend more. So he's saying the government should spend more. And he actually said that after the 9/11 attacks in 2001, he said, well, at least one good thing about these attacks, because of all the destruction, is going to benefit the economy because people have to get a lot, everything repaired that all the plane crashes cause. They'll have to spend a lot of money doing all these repairs. So he's actually, he was falling into exactly the broken window fallacy on a much more massive scale that Basquiat was talking about. But leaving that one aside, where he's talking about actual destruction, we can see how the broken window fallacy applies just as straightforward proposal the government should spend money in order to get us out of the depression. Well, suppose we leave the side case where the government just expands the money supply. So it doesn't expand the money supply, but just spends more. That's the Keynesian remedy. It's fiscal policy. Government increasing supply of money, then wouldn't this be diverting spending from other things? So it's the same point Basquiat is making. What would be seen is the government is spending money on various projects it chooses to spend money on, but it's neglecting that it has to get the money from somewhere, and if it hadn't taken the money from people to spend on the project, and those people would have spent the money on something else. And again, this is just putting to one side cases where the government expands the money supply. Here we're assuming a constant money supply, and so, well, the government is spending money, has to really get the money from people, and then wouldn't those people have spent it on something else? Now, the Keynesians are aware of this objection. What do they say in response? Well, they say that sometimes the broken window fallacy isn't a fallacy. They say sometimes broken window reasoning really works, because they say if we have a time of depression and unemployment, then the alternative government spending may not be spending on something else. So remember, in the Basiat analysis, we're saying, Basiat said, well, look, if there hadn't been a broken window, the person who spends the money repairing the window would spend it on something else. So the Keynesians say, well, if you have a depression and the government didn't spend the money, then people might not have spent their money on anything. People could just hoard money, just keep the money. Why would they do that if they got money? Why would you want to keep it after all? Money used to buy things. So what the Keynesians say is, well, people think prices are going down, so they want to wait until for prices to fall further before they start spending it, anything. So then the Keynesians say, well, they'll just be a downward spiral, because if people stop spending, then prices are going to go down, and then people think they'll go down further, so they'll keep withholding money, and then this will kind of cause a total collapse, because people just think, I don't want to spend anything yet because prices are going down, so I'm going to wait. And then if nobody spends things, if there's a massive decrease in spending, then that will cause unemployment and depression will worsen. Now, this dispute between the Keynesians and their opponents is one that we've studied before. Remember when we were talking about Jean-Baptiste Say, we discussed Say's law. I mean, it does make sense, don't you think, if we're having, am I going to mention Say's law, we should discuss it in a lecture about Say. And remember, Say's law is that there can't be general overproduction, because the demand for commodities and goods and services is simply supply of other goods and services. So there can't be a gap between production and spending on consumption, because spending on consumption just is spending on production. It wouldn't be, there could be shortages and surpluses in particular areas, but not throughout the whole economy. So defenders of Say's law, and of course Rothbard is one of them, they say that saving money, people just taking money out and say, putting it in the mattress or putting it in the bank, doesn't alter the fact that there can't be a general overproduction. So remember, Keynesians are saying, look, if you take money out, then you're not, and you don't invest it or spend it, you can have unemployment and depression, because it's just kind of taken out of the economy. You have to have spending on things in order to get the economy going. If you just take the money out, you're not spending on anything, then it's going to have bad results. So what the defenders of Say's law claim, at least one of the things they say, is, well, supposing money is hoarded, people just don't think prices are going down, they don't spend the money on anything, then money's going to be worth more because if prices are going down, you can buy more with the same amount of money. And then as you see your money is worth more, you're eventually going to spend it. You can get some real bargains. If you think the price is going down, you're not just going to keep waiting. You'll see the value of your money is going up, and you won't want to keep that much money. You'll start spending it on things. You can get a lot of good bargains if the price goes down. And this is called the real balance effect, or the Pigou effect. Pigou was an economist. He was actually one of Keynes' teachers who wrote about this effect, that if there's hoarding and the value of money goes up, then people will eventually spend the money. So that's the way the anti-Keynesians, or at least one way the anti-Keynesians would answer the Keynesian reply to the broken window argument. Now, so of course Bastiat wrote a lot more than just on the broken window fallacy, but some people who write about 19, as Steve says, in other words, there are a lot of money hoarding, people, price will fall, and people will know it's right. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Okay, so some people say, well, Bastiat was a very talented pamphleteer. He was kind of a good, great economic journalist, but he really wasn't a significant original thinker. Karl Marx was one who was very derogatory about Bastiat. He said, well, Bastiat's just an apologist for the capitalist class. He never really did anything. And even Joseph Schumpeter, who called, I think, Bastiat a pamphleteer of genius, doesn't rate him that highly as an original theorist. But both Rothbard and Hayek rate Bastiat very highly. This is one point, remember I was mentioning earlier, that Rothbard and Hayek have very different views about when they're comparing the French and British classical liberal tradition, but they both agree that Bastiat was a very significant theorist. And, what are some of Bastiat's contributions? Well, remember Adam Smith emphasized, when he was studying economics, he emphasized in production, and the title of his book is An Inquiry into the Nature and Cause of the Wealth of Nations. He's saying, does a nation produce things? And this is, you find this in Ricardo, Principles of Economics, concerned with what goes on in the process of production. But Bastiat said, well, really, the primary thing in economics is consumption. Production is for the purpose of consumption. So the most important thing to study in economics is exchange. And remember, this is sounds like an elementary point. It's very easy to understand, but it's one of the key principles in economics. If there's an exchange, each person in the exchange expects the benefit. So remember, Marx said in the exchange there's an equality. If goods exchange, if I exchange apples, my apples for your oranges, somehow the apples have to be equal to the oranges. So Bastiat said, no, in exchange you don't have equality, you have an inequality. Each person wants what he's getting more than what he's giving up. So in exchange, all the parties expect to benefit. Now, one thing Bastiat also, something that Adam Smith held that Bastiat rejected, and Rothbard thinks he was entirely correct in rejecting it, is Smith distinguished between what he called productive labor and unproductive labor. In doing this, he didn't mean to suggest that all unproductive labor is bad, although we are suspicious of a lot of it. But productive labor was working on material goods, say if you're a shoemaker, you're working on some material goods, and unproductive labor is really services, you're advertising goods, or you're selling things, or you're doing other things that don't involve your actually making material goods. So Smith said, well, the only really productive goods are when you're working on material goods. The other thing really is kind of parasitical on the productive goods. Unproductive goods, their services. Now, can anybody see this kind of an obvious point why Smith probably wouldn't want to say that all unproductive labor is bad? Why would you think Smith wouldn't want to say this? Yes, I think Jacob, he would be singing himself out. Yes, I mean, remember, he was a customs official. He was previously, most of his career, he was a professor. So, I mean, he's not engaging in any productive labor by his own account either. So he wouldn't want to have said, presumably didn't think what he was doing was bad. So he wouldn't want to say all unproductive labor in his sense was bad. But Basquiat rejects this whole distinction. For Basquiat, all goods are services. And why did he say that? He said, well, supposing we take, say, some physical good, like, say, an old chop of apples and oranges. He said, well, what we want is not the physical good just by itself, but we want the satisfaction the good provides. So we want oranges, say, we want to eat the orange. So what we're really looking at is, according to Basquiat, what we really want is the satisfaction from material good. So in the service, there's no material good, but we have satisfaction directly. So he said, what we all goods are really just satisfaction, and physical goods are just a means that we can get satisfaction. So for Basquiat, all goods really are services, either direct services or indirect, because the physical good will enable us to get some service about it. And he had, there's a formula he uses, the slogan where he says, one effort, satisfaction. We have certain things we want, certain desires, and we exert ourselves, we labor, do things to get to fulfill these wants, and then if we do that, we're enabled to satisfy these wants. We get what we want through working about, through working to achieve it. So, this one effort satisfaction. As I said before, Basquiat stressed consumption as the goal of economic activity. Now, what Basquiat was probably most famous for in his own lifetime, he lived not very long, 1801 to 1850. I remember quite a number of years ago, I was at the Mises University, and Richard Vedder said to me something when Basquiat was your age, he'd been dead 7 years. That was a typical Richard Vedder remark. So, as I say, Basquiat was the greatest popular defender of free trade. And in one of his essays called Petitioner of Candlemakers, he made fun of the way protectionists will try to restrict production in order to advance their own interests. A protectionist will say, well, we have to build up a certain industry, say we have to build up the steel industry, so we have to prevent foreign steel from coming in, because that will take away, will make it harder for, say, our steel industry to produce things. Now, it's certainly true if you have foreign industry coming in, that makes it harder for the domestic industry to function to win the competition. But the key point is the way it's proposed by tariffs to advance domestic production is to restrict foreign production. So when you're restricting people from access to things, you're lowering their welfare because you're saying people can engage in exchanges that they think would benefit themselves. So in this, Bachat makes fun of the way the protections are. You kind of should, like coming up with kind of a satirical example. You say, imagine candle makers saying they want all windows to be covered and people should be in darkness because the sun is providing unfair competition to the candle makers. Why would you want to buy a candle, say, during the day if you can have free sunlight, so don't have to shut out the sun in order to help the candle maker? And now, besides being a writer defending free trade, he was much more than just a writer. He was a very active influence in French politics, especially after the Revolution of 1848. Remember, that was the one that expelled the Orleanist king, Louis Philippe, who had reigned in 1830 to 1848. So Basquiat was a member first of the Constituent Assembly, which was going to set up a new constitution for France, and then the Legislative Assembly. And he was a good friend of Richard Cobden, the great Manchester manufacturer, defender of free trade in England. He influenced Cobden in his economic views. And Cobden, in 1860, long after Bachat had died, negotiated a trade treaty with France. So Bachat had really had a lot of influence on political events. He influenced people all over Europe. For example, in Prussia, we don't think of Prussia usually as a classical liberal country, but there was a classical liberal movement which was led by someone named John Prince Smith. Ralph Raichel's written about him. So he's been influenced by Basquiat and led a classical liberal and free trade movement. Now you might think, well, John Prince Smith doesn't sound like a German name, but he'd been born in England and he went to Germany with his family later on. Now, another point I want to mention while we're still on Basquiat, who I thought I wanted to concentrate on Basquiat in this lecture, because I thought he's the most important thinker that was discussed in the chapter, the one that Rothbard esteems the most. In his pamphlet, The Law, he made a very important contribution to libertarian political theory. And what he says there, I remember this pamphlet, I was very much influenced by this. It's one of the first things I read in the classical liberal tradition. I read it when I was in junior high school, which was a long time ago, I can assure you. So what Bachat said is the state can't acquire new rights that individuals don't have. Bachat thought, say, people could delegate to the state their right to protect themselves. So I have a right to defend myself, so I could say, well, I'm going to delegate this right to this other body. Everybody else could do so also. But the state can't do anything, can't legitimately do anything that individuals couldn't do in a state of nature. So we couldn't, state couldn't say, well, we're going to redistribute income from the rich to the poor, because in the state of nature, if I were poor, I wouldn't have the right to take money from people who are richer than I am. So the state can't acquire that right if individuals don't have such a right before the state is formed. And also in the law, he criticizes socialists and planners for wanting to control society. He said, well, you look at somebody like the Abe Mabli, who's one of the discussants of Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, that they have these plans for how society should be organized. But in these plans, they have a whole system. Everybody else has to be forced to do what they want. So they really want to impose their values on others. And he said, this actually was a precursor to the famous argument that Friedrich Hayek had in his 1944 book, Road to Serfdom, where he made a very similar point. He said, people in society have different values. We all have different value judgments. And socialist planners say, well, we have to have kind of a central organization of the economy, but in order to have that, we have to have a central plan. We have to be based on certain values. We want to produce certain things over other things. We have to have kind of some value scale telling us what to produce. And this, if we followed that, so we have to do in a plan, it would be imposing the values of the planners on everybody else. So Basquiat really pioneered this type of argument. Now, another very important writer kind of took the argument of Basquiat that the state can acquire new rights that individuals don't have before the state was formed. He extended this in a very interesting way. Gustave de Molinari, who lived, as you can see, quite a long time, 1819 to 1912. So he lived, although he was Belgian, he lived most of his life in France, and he was associated with the French classical liberals. So what he said is that, well, if free competition is good, if we're classical liberals, we say the free market is good, why not competition among protection agencies as well? So Rothbard said he was the first anarcho-capitalist because he favored capitalist organization of the economy, but he said, why do we have to have a single state? So we could use Basquiat's own argument really against having a state at all, because individuals in a state of nature, they could certainly delegate their right to protect themselves to some other group. But one thing you wouldn't be able to do in a state of nature is forbid other people from forming their own protection agencies. So if you applied Basquiat's argument consistently, I think you would have to come up with an anarcho-capitalist system. I don't say that, it seems like if you apply Basquiat consistently, Basquiat's principle of law, that you could get to an anarchist position, although of course Basquiat himself didn't take that step. Now, most of the French classical liberals thought that Molinari's proposal was too radical. So they really didn't say much about it. One person who did was Charles Dumoyer. You know, he was one of the great classical liberals. He was one of the founders of the libertarian class analysis. And he had an objection that actually is one of those very frequently used against the libertarian anarchist position today. He said, well, you had competing protection agencies, wouldn't they get into violent conflict? And so he said, this really wouldn't work unless we had a single state. Of course, he wanted a very limited state. He said, then these competing agencies would get into violent fights. But Rothbard suggests, there are really a couple answers to this. First, don't nations get into fights with each other, so we already have conflict. And also, if you have the private protection agencies in competition, they'd have some incentive to reach agreements on how to settle disputes. So Rothbard thinks, you couldn't really say impossible that these protection agencies would get into conflicts, but they have an incentive to come to some sort of agreement. But despite the fact that the French Black liberals didn't accept like Molinari's argument on this, they still respected him a lot. They didn't feel, well, he's got this extreme proposal, so he's crazy. No, they thought he was a very important writer. There's something in toward the end of his life, Molinari wasn't kind of modified his views somewhat. He wasn't as strict an anarchist as before. He seemed to think, well, maybe he would have to settle for a limited state. Now, the last person I want to talk about, I'm going a little old because we started later today, was Vilfredo Pareto, one of the great neoclassical economists, also a famous sociologist, who lived from 1848 to 1923. Now, he was very strongly influenced by Molinari, and he adopted the French libertarian class theory. So he argued that protectionism and other restrictionist measures, where people are going to the government and say we have to interfere with the free market, there are ways some groups, with the help of the state, can act as predators on others. So instead of, say, in a market exchange, all the parties to exchange benefit because you wouldn't get into an exchange unless you expect to benefit from it. One thing you can do is go to the state and get them to restrict other people so that you'll benefit. Of course, the people you restrict do not benefit, so you're really benefiting at the expense of other people. And Pareto viewed the state as predatory, like from Oppenheimer, Albert J. Knock later. So he said, well, instead of being productive and trying to get what you want by producing things other people want and then exchanging, if you go to the state, then you can just seize things from other people. So he's viewing the state as predatory. But so Pareto then started off his career as very much a classical liberal follower of Molinari. But after there was, as I mentioned, there was a move towards statism in the 1870s, there's been this kind of international movement that isn't free trade a great thing, would it be great if we start getting rid of tariffs and putting in free market measures. There was a movement against that in the 1870s, so Pareto became rather cynical. He thought that, the classical liberal measures are really the best ones, but people are just motivated by these predatory instincts. They want to seize things, tell people to expend. So he became less of a political advocate, more of a detached observer. So he said, well, you can't really convince people by rational arguments that the free market is the best system. What you can do, though, is just kind of study how people will try to work for their own advantage. And he spent a lot of time analyzing the motives of various social movements. He tended to take a very skeptical view of what people said. He said, well, people will give different justifications for what they're doing, but they have different moral arguments or political arguments. But these arguments are really just cloaks for their self-interest. So people really have their motives or really just to advance their own power or economic interests. And he didn't really place much credence in what people said. And he ended up his life, died in 1923, and remember Mussolini came to power in Italy at the end of 1922. So he ended up as a supporter of Mussolini, a fascist leader, and he was, I think Mussolini made him a member of the Italian Senate. So when he started off as a classical liberal, he never abandoned classical liberal economic views, but he wound up as a supporter of Mussolini. So on that, the paradoxical note, I think I'll close now. So if you have questions, you can put them either in the chat or the Q&A. So I'll open the Q&A box in case anyone wants to type something in there as well. Now, Steve said, do you feel Mises would have regarded himself as more of a modern class liberal than a libertarian? Well, I think that would depend on how you were to characterize libertarianism. If you meant it to be something like a Rothbardian anarchist position, you wouldn't have accepted that. But sometimes people today, let's say they're political theorists who say about libertarians, or some people who say there shouldn't be any government interference in the market, but classical liberals are willing to tolerate some government programs, like maybe a minimum safety net for people or some government support of education. And Mises didn't support that. He would have come down more on the libertarian side, I think, in general. He didn't favor any government involvement in the economy. Now, there was one rather glaring exception, which came in the second edition of Human Action. Unfortunately, Mises supported conscription. I guess he thought the Cold War was very serious. He earlier had very good argument against conscription, but for some reason he changed his mind. Somewhat of a mystery why he did that. But in general, he was against all government interventions, so that extent he would have been on the libertarian side. And Mike says Bastiat would have been libertarian. Yes, I think Bastiat would have been what they would call a limited state libertarian. Yes, pretty much so. Now, Steve says, of all the people who've studied during this course, are there one or two who consider it your favorite? If so, why? I like Bastiat a lot. He was a very, very good writer. I think he's one of the top ones. I suppose I would pick him. I mean, you know, it wouldn't, for a lot of lectures in the course, we've been devoting to people who were on the enemies list, like Marx or Ricardo, so we wouldn't want to pick them. Now, Lee says, who would you say was the first libertarian economist ever? Well, I mean, somebody who thought we could do away. I mean, there were certainly people who thought there should be a free economy, say, among the Spanish scholastics. But they still favored having a government that would be doing things that would be non-classical liberal. You know, they favor sort of much more power for the church and the state that would be compatible with classical liberalism. You find this even with Turgot, you know, favored the government control of education. So I would think maybe you wouldn't get libertarian economists till some of the early French school, you know, like, say, Estée de Trastevere, but I'd have to look into that. Now, Michael says, how exactly did Mercantilism and Socialism replace capitalism in the late 19th century? Well, that was the story Rothbard intended to get into in the third volume. But basically, the economic theory responded to development in politics, and the people in most European countries who were in control of the state didn't really accept the notion the state should be limited. They wanted to advance their own power. So there were various intellectuals, what Rothbard called court intellectuals, who developed ideas that would support them. And so I think that's how especially this happened in Germany with the later German historical school, Otto Wagner, Gustav Schmoller, particular enemy of Mises, later Werner Sombart. So we had people who were saying, well, the classical liberal stuff is wrong if you consider historical evidence, you'll see that we have a powerful state. Now, Bob said, how active is the free market tradition among contemporary French economists? Well, it isn't the dominant view. There are free market French economists. Pascal Salin is one. Of course, you have Guido Holtzmann, who isn't French, but he teaches in France. He's an Austrian economist. And then Maurice Allais, who's pretty sympathetic to the free market, although not entirely, was a Nobel Prize winner from France. He actually thought very highly of Rothbard's book on the Great Depression. Now, Leslie says, how much were Molinari's ideas being discussed in Europe in this period? Nietzsche has an interesting passage in All Too Human, which he discusses private security companies and eventual disappearance of state. Oh, I didn't know that. That's most interesting. I hadn't known that. I have to check that out. Nietzsche, I think people, or certainly people who read Molinari, was very widely read journalist. I don't think he was sort of one of the major figures, but people, there were people certainly aware of him. But I hadn't known that about Nietzsche. I must look into that. Veronique de Rugy, as she written about this, I don't know her work on this. I know, I'll look into this. Thank you, Leslie. I know Nietzsche had a lot of political interest. He was very anti-socialist. There's an Italian pro-communist writer, Dominique Lacerdo, who wrote about Nietzsche's politics, and was very much against Nietzsche because Nietzsche was anti-socialist. I think Veronique de Rugy is working at the Mercatus Center now near George Mason University. Bob says, Rothbard seems very theologically literate. Yes, he's very interested in theology. Was he a theist? No, although I think toward the end of his life, he wasn't quite as insistent on atheism as he had been before. I think his position at the end of his life was he was still an atheist, but he thought that if God existed, God would be a being that we couldn't really comprehend in our own thought. It would be operating in completely different categories from those of human beings. But I never really gave up his atheism, as far as I know. Well, I'll tell you one very funny story. You know, you asked about what was Rothbard an atheist. One of the early Mises universities, one was held at Stanford, there was a quite old lady who was in the class, and she had kind of odd ways of asking questions. So we were having in one of the sort of question and answer sessions, she said, this is the way she pronounced it, said, was Mises an atheist? And then I think the person said, yes, and she said, why? And then I think it was Rothbard who said, yes, she said, why? And then she said, are you an atheist? Why? Then I think the next evening, again had a question and answer period, and she got up again, and she said, was Mises an atheist? And Rothbard said, hey, you asked me that last night. So now she says, can you tell a little bit about your upcoming course in June? Political Thought in the Age of July, and a shrug. Well, in the one in Political Thought, we're just going to take some important writers like Plato, Aristotle, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau. We're going to consider especially how they tried to justify the state, or of course in the Locke case, King is really pretty close to a non-state system, non-child. We're going to see what kind of arguments they had. More, and then we'll consider also arguments by Spooner and Rothbard and some other people opposing the state. But in general, it's a survey of political philosophy coming from a libertarian perspective. And Atlas Shrugged, I think, will be this kind of a fun way to get some of grasp of what objectivist philosophy is, and what we consider the Rand's philosophy, and also some kind of the literary qualities of the book, and so on. And I should mention while we're talking, this Friday, if anyone's interested, I'm giving one lecture on Henry Hazlitt's book, Foundations of Morality, kind of a one lecture course. It'll be Friday, 6:30 Eastern Time, this coming Friday, June 1st. And one advantage of that course, there's no charge for it. So anyone who wants to listen to it can get it into this. I see Alec asked, do you think Plato's 80-20 rule, which is 80% of property belongs to 20% of people, led him to supporting Mussolini fascism? Well, I think to the extent if he thought that socialist efforts of socialists and communists to kind of overthrow private property system wouldn't work, it would be a very bad system. I think he thought that Mussolini would really be able to stop the socialists from taking over. And he thought at first Mussolini seemed to have some ideas that were sympathetic to classical liberalism and economics. I think he supported Mussolini. My preference would be 100% zero then. Well, I mean, to the extent, I suppose you could say, that the fascist system was fully imposed, but I mean, in practice, it allowed considerable scope to a private economy. The corporatist system was never really fully put into place in Italy. And now Matthew says, Menger Bombard with another answer, emphasizes economic laws, exact laws, the classical economics also the economics law, and this man, the Austrian view, exact law, you need to. So, but you do find in some of the classical law, like Ricardo, you do find notion of exact laws. So I think, of course, looking at it rather differently from the way the Austrians do, not the same laws. I mean, you do have, say, what we intend to be exact laws among Ricardo. Now, Mill didn't have that. Remember, John Stuart Mill said, well, economic laws are based on certain abstractions like homo economicus, economic man, and they tell you what follows from that assumption, but then you have to combine that with other things if you want to know what's actually happening. And also, he said there are laws of distribution, so he would be one who wasn't stressing exact laws so much. But some of the classical ones did. Craig says, I'm very curious, the French classical liberals respected him all in all. Do we have any knowledge of what Manuel Mombalik and Mises thought of him? Well, I don't recall offhand any place they discussed Molinari. I do know that Mises did not think very highly of Franz Oppenheimer, who has this predatory theory of state. He mentions him, I think, in one place. I have to look up the section. He's quite critical of him. So he doesn't accept. Mises was not an anarchist. He didn't accept that, although you can get kind of an anarchist argument from certain things Mises says about that secession is all right, even on an individual level. But Mises was not a supportive Oppenheimer. I don't recall if he said anything about Molinari and Mankel and Bombach either. Maybe they did, but I just don't remember it. Susan, outside of economics, who among your favorite philosophers? Any modern 21st century ones? Well, that's even modern. Well, I always liked Bob Nozick. You know, I knew him for 20 years. He's very good. Thomas Nagel was a very good philosopher. Saul Kripke. Quine was one of the great. I had kind of pretty standard views. David Lewis was very good. And I have pretty standard views. You know, I like some, and now there's a British philosopher I used to like, Cambridge philosopher. J.M.E. McTaggart was one of the great, one of the British idealists, was a great, fine philosopher. I like Peter Geech and Mr. Vance. And, you know, are the ones you like especially? Or, Leslie says, what did Pareto think of Austrian objections to the use of mathematics and statistics in economics? Well, he had, you know, you can look in Israel Curzon's book, Economic Point of View. I think there was a debate between Pareto and the Italian liberal Benedetto Croce on method in economics. So Pareto really didn't accept, you know, you really do have to use math and statistics. He didn't accept the Austrian objection. And you can, if you read Curzon's book, you can see the controversy he had with Croce. Croce wasn't an Austrian, but he had views on method that were somewhat compatible with the Austrian. So you can see that Pareto didn't like those objections. Pareto was, in his philosophy, somewhat of a positivist. Thought that really knowledge that you're trying to do in economics is really emulate what they do in the natural science. Remember, he was a disciple of Léon Walras. Walras' successor, a professor of economics at the University of Geneva, so he had a very kind of mathematical way of doing economics. Now, she said, I've been heavily used by Ayn Rand, my judgment to understand other view. Well, that's good. I hope you can take my course in Atlas Shrugged. maybe you find that interesting. Well, does anyone have any other questions? We're about out of time. We could go on a bit more if you have more questions, but I started a few minutes late. I'm glad I got through the lecture, because when they didn't send me the message that they were opening WebEx, I did what anyone would do in such a situation. I had a panic attack, but I managed to get through that. And I should tell you, as you know, this is the last lecture in this course. I do have one more of my impossible to do quizzes for you, but this is the last lecture, and I want to thank everybody for coming to my class. Maggie says Nietzsche seemed quite controversial. Well, I think Nietzsche had many insights, and a lot of people who study Nietzsche as well, he's one of the important thinkers. And he had some good insights. I like to call it the state, that coldest of all cold monsters. Okay, thanks everybody. So, hope we'll see you. Hope some of you come to the free lecture Friday. I mean, you can't beat the price. I suppose you could if people would pay you to come, but we tried to beat a free price. Okay, thanks everybody. Hope to see you again soon.